back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. I'm wearing my Fadley shirt for those of you watching out on the internet. We're going to be bringing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour back down to Fadley's for a big fat crab cake, a little mustard, and some delicious mac and cheese down at Lexington Market. They're coming to Catonsville as well. Reminder, the Maryland Lottery is presenting the Maryland Crab Cake Tour. It starts at Mama's on the Half Shell down in Canton. We're going to be on the square doing it proper, eating scunny crab cake, and probably having a beverage or two before it's all over with. Don, I've asked you to pick this program up and invite some first timers on. And that's challenging because we're like almost going into our fourth year of doing this, right? So we've had all sorts of people, politicians, pundits, friends, enemies on the program. And so it is, when I ask you, dig me out some new awesome guests. This, you've reached the top on this one. This one's going to be a good one.
Oh, this is a good one. Legendary Baltimore Sun reporter, 20 years, went on to, I think, and we'll talk about it, I think, do some work with the Maryland Matters when it was a fledgling little startup. We'll talk about that. And then, of course, on to much fame at HBO with The Wire and Show Me a Hero and the upcoming We Own This City. So it's a pleasure to welcome in Bill Zorsi. Bill, welcome to Baltimore Positive.
Thank you, Don. I appreciate that. Thanks.
Bill, I had to laugh. One of the descriptions in reading some stuff, getting ready for you, they said, Bill was tough and cranky. Did you buy into the description of tough and cranky?
I think most everybody would buy into that description of tough and cranky.
Bill, is that something you honed over the years?
Bill, I look like a softy, man, but like every reporter and editor I ever loved in our building down on Calvert Street was a curmudgeon. I mean, Phil Jackman was my mentor, right? So like curmudgeon and Jackman were there. There is something about being a writer and being critical, and being critical thinking leads some people to think you're being too negative.
Hey, Bill, Nestor told our friend Fraser Smith, who was on a number of times, that he was afraid of Fraser.
I was afraid of Fraser. I was afraid of you. I never came up. Serious cats. I mean, like Simon and Raphael would be coming by me at like 2 a.m. up on the 5th floor, and I would get them Chinese food from Young sometimes. But I tried to stay out of the reporter's way. The only reporter that ever loved me, Dick Irwin. Dick would come over and put his feet up and start telling the cop tales of what happened tonight or whatever. But all you cats were really, really serious investigating murders. And I was 17 years old running around the newsroom, man. I just needed to stay out of the way. And some of you saw some gruesome stuff that made you a curmudgeon.
I think that might be it. I think it's just sort of being exposed to, you know, what life is out there in the world, and seeing it up close and being, you know, being witness to a lot of it. I think that sort of adds to the curmudgeonliness of.
But that's also added to your creativity, though, right? I mean, that's part of experiencing that in a way that maybe I'm too timid to go to the crime scene, that you've been there a million times, and that allows you to make the kind of productions that you've made in your life, right?
Well, I went to a number of crime scenes, but I wasn't really a crime reporter per se. You know, I mean, I did cover cops mostly in Howard County when it wasn't really, you know, quite what it is today. And, you know, I sort of saw life up close a little more terrifyingly by being a political reporter, you know? So I was exposed to a whole different, you know, scene of
carnage
there. Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to get into all of the politics stuff. Before we do though, Bill, you and I chatted briefly this morning as we came on the air. Nestor and I have been talking about it. It's almost unimaginable the images that we're seeing in the discussion as Russia invades a sovereign country and the Ukrainian people are at risk. And as a longtime political observer and someone who I'm sure was up late last night trying to make sense of this, what's your immediate reaction as someone who's covered government for a long time of what we're seeing?
I don't know. We joked, you know, earlier or a minute ago. That was a joke, by the way. That's sort of the extent of my humor. But it just is shocking to me. It truly was shocking to me, and I couldn't take my eyes off of it last night, even though it was, you know, as TV is want to be a little difficult to watch at times, but it's just, you know, it made me think of, I guess coming up as a kid, I always wondered how Hitler managed to do what he did in the 30s. And I even, you know, I have this thing that's stuck in my mind, this image in my mind many years later of when Russia came in to squash the Hungarian Revolution and, you know, people throwing rocks at tanks. So all these things are sort of in the back of my mind as I'm watching this play out in real time. And it was, it sort of really struck a very somber tone in my mind as I sort of approach this, what I thought would be sort of a gas today, you know, but I'm not sure that, you know, there's a little bit of a cloud hanging over.
Oh, it's heavy. I mean, we felt it from the time I woke up this morning. I don't know how we could talk about anything else. You know, something I sit around here talking about the Orioles and baseball lockouts and who the Ravens are. And I'm like, this is horrific. And to your point on the political side, this is what happens when politics goes wrong, right? When you get it wrong. I mean, we have a former president praising this right now, like literally a guy that 75 million people are on that side of the cult and say this is good and whatever he says is good. And he seems to like Putin, and Putin seems to be a nice man. That there is a faction in our country that just would have been unspeakable in 1985 here, that we would have felt that way about anything Soviet.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that is shocking, actually, that part. But I mean, I also wonder about things like, you know, I guess just looking back over history, I've wondered myself, like, how did Huey Long get to be where he got? And how did, you know, Father Coughlin get to be where he got? And, you know, I think we see now through those, where the 75 million people have led us, I think we see how, you know, in real time, as they like to say,
How we got element. There. Bill, I couldn't agree more. That element has always been there. And I'm one, actually, we talked with your former colleague, Peter Jensen, recently. And I said to Peter, I'm one of the folks who subscribe to the belief that had there been a Fox News during Watergate, Richard Nixon would have served two full terms. I believe that with a Steve Bannon and a Fox News, it would have been perhaps Barry Goldwater and Howard Baker and others would have stepped up. I'm not so sure.
Right. I don't know. I don't know.
Well, it speaks to the power to what you've done, you know, in the course of your life and report on this, right? And reporting on what politicians are really after, where they're getting their money, all of these issues. But I think all this through now on the information and the questions we've had to ask all of our lives start to matter when world wars start to happen again, right? And or when we say, are we going to participate or are we not going to participate? And what do sanctions mean against tyranny, against evil?
Well, yeah, I don't know if I have anything to do with that, you know, or I can, you know,
being in the news media and controlling minds, I'm talking about, you know,
I don't think of myself as controlling minds, but okay.
Well, disseminating information so people can make up their own mind.
Right.
Issue of Fox News, because it says news on it, people think it's truth.
Well, that's a whole other issue.
Well, Bill,
these are the issues we talk about here.
Well, looking back at your career, and before we get into all of the HBO projects and your passion project, which was, you know, Show Me a Hero. When you look back at your 20, I look when you were there from the 70s to the 90s, there were some real characters in state government that you were covering. And I mean, you were one of the most respected government reporters at that time. Who were some of the folks that when you write your memoir, there'll be a chapter on that you'll say, boy, is it William Donald Schaefer? Is it who is it that is it Marvin Mandel? Who sticks out for you?
Well, all those guys stick out. I mean, but I, you know, how do you ignore Schaefer, really? I mean, I'm sure you knew him. he was an absolute character, you know, and you never knew what you were going to get, although you usually had a pretty good idea. So I sort of, you know, covered him as I didn't sort of cover him. I actually did cover him, as governor. So, you know, Marvin was his own guy. I didn't really cover him until after the fall. You know,
Schaefer was unhappy by the time he got to the state house, right? Like, he was a different kind of politician as a governor than he was as a mayor, as it's been told to me by people like Fraser.
I don't know. I don't know that. I'd have to think about that for a minute. Like, I don't know. I don't know that he was happier as I guess he was happier as mayor. Maybe that's what Fraser meant.
Well, I think he really built something. I mean, I lived this shot was taken from where I lived the last 19 years at Harbor Court. And I mean, I saw another business went out at Harbor Place, but every time I ever walked through the Inner Harbor, I mean, there's a real connection to him in every single way in the city. I don't know that the state, by the time he got to the state and the memoirs and the things that I've read, but during that period of time, what he had built in Baltimore is just, we're still sort of eating off it today, 40 years later.
That's true. That is true. No, I mean, I think Maryland, you know, I mean, it's a big state for the America miniature that it is. You know, it is difficult to leave that kind of mark on the whole of a state as opposed to the whole of a city. So I guess I see that point. Yeah.
Let's go back to this way. Then you talk about Schaefer. I'm always fascinated. And we did talk to Fraser a lot about William Donald Schaefer. What was his magic sauce, Bill? What made William Donald Schaefer an effective leader? Because one of the things we like to talk about on here is leadership. What made him effective? And you covered him a long time.
I don't think I saw that one coming. I don't know. I guess it was his quirkiness and the fact that he did actually care about things and care about doing things right. And
were you ever on the receiving side of any of his tirades as a reporter?
Absolutely. Absolutely. frequently, I think, or at times I was, you know, and he would just walk by and, or I mean, there is one sort of, I think this is probably as close as I'll get to a memoir. I had written a piece about returning to cover Annapolis for Maryland Matters. And it was, you know, 30 years after the fact when I had first gone there. And I included a piece in a conversation that I happened to have that never made the newspaper, but I held on to the quote, and it was a quote about Schaefer yelling at me and saying, you know, I don't know what you're trying to do. What the hell you're trying to do to me? If you're trying to have me indicted or have me, it just went on and on and on. I was like dumb. I was comic, really. So I sort of, and I understood that sort of reaction to things because it is off-putting and it's sort of a conversational trick, you know, if you will. So maybe that's a power, you know, indicative of his ability to manipulate power. I don't know. But
Bill, during that period of time in newspapers, I mean, and I was in the same newsroom as you and we were colleagues without knowing it, but like, my dad was pissed at me in 1992 and he died that year for leaving the paper. You know, I took a buyout in early 92. I was 23 years old. I wasn't of the mindset that there will never be a newspaper there, right? I was always of the mindset of, yeah, there'll be a newspaper here the rest of my life. My dad wanted me to get a gold watch, wanted me to be Oscar Madison and take Stedman's job and like all that stuff. And I left and I got pushed out of newspapers very early on and have watched, you know, over three decades, the sort of deterioration of the business side of it. You were there a little longer and a little later and felt it. But did you feel like when you were early in your career, you would have been a newspaper guy your whole career, that when you're Googled now, television pops up, right? And that side of it. But I think for many people, for me as a, I thought it was a job for life. I really did want to do that work forever, thinking there would always be a hard newspaper. That my mind at 20 is a lot different than at 50 about all of that. And clearly the banner's coming. The sun is what it is at this point, but you probably wanted to be a newspaper reporter your whole life. If it existed as a vocation,
I guess. I don't know that I ever thought about that. You know what I mean? I don't think I ever really planned on, I haven't really planned on very much in my life, to be honest with you. But
that's why it turned out so good.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that. But I never thought about the gold watch. You know, I did always think about being a newspaper reporter. My father was a newspaper reporter, but also before me, but then got out of the game because, and went into PR because he had to pay for us to all go to school and put clothes on our back and things like that. But
so Bill, you step away from the Sun to pursue this, as I've read it, passion project of Show Me a Hero. And I was fascinated by that when it came out, because it,
oh wow, you were one of the 70 people who watched it.
Oh, I love it. I will start with my spoiler alert. If our listeners now go back and watch it, Oscar Isaac is amazing as Mayor Nick Wasicko. I guess that's how I pronounce it.
Wasicko.
you know, in Yonkers, Westchester County, New York, an issue that is as prevalent today as it was back then in terms of affordable housing. And at the time, another senior advisor to Kevin Kamenetz, and I was Kevin's chief of staff, said to Kevin at the time, hey, because he loved policy and policy debates, and affordable housing was always an issue in Baltimore County. So we said, hey, you've got to watch this series on HBO, Show Me a Hero. It is terrific. He said, oh, I haven't started yet. I said, but I will. I said, no, you've got to watch it. So about a week, 2 weeks later, he comes in and Kevin Loeb and I are staying there, and Kevin Kamenetz throws his hands up and he goes, he commits suicide. The mayor commits suicide. Why did you think I was going to be inspired by a mayor? And we just burned. I can never think of that show without thinking about that. But Bill, talk about that project, how it came to your attention, why you were so passionate and finally able to get it on the air after evidently many fits and starts.
Well, I don't know that it was really ever my passion per se. I'm not sure, you know, I don't know about that, but, you know, David Simon, my, I guess occasional writing partner, and I knew him, you know, I guess I first met him and we had many good adventures together, professional and otherwise, at the paper, came to me and said, you got to come. By that point, he had left the Sun, and he was, he had done his bit with Homicide, the TV show for NBC. And they were working on, at that point, they were working on the beginning of The Wire, the first season of The Wire. And he just said to me, you need to do this. You need to come eat from my deli tray, as the expression goes, and you know, read this book and you'll love it, blah, blah, blah. It was based on a book by Lisa Belkin, formerly of the New York Times. And actually he called on deadline, as he might, and as I have come to expect. And I, you know, frankly, I forgot about it. I mean, I just said, yeah, okay. Cause you know, I had copy to move for, you know, through the desk. And cause I, by that point I had stopped reporting and I had become an editor. I'm embarrassed to say, but.
Ate better Chinese food.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Well, were you on the Calvert Street at that point or down in the new tank?
Oh, I've never been. I left in 2000.
Okay. So it was Calvert Street.
2002. Right. So it was
Calvert Street. Sure. Okay. Sure.
So, he called me back like, I don't know, 6 weeks later or something, and said, on deadline again, you know, and I'm like, yeah. And he said, so did you read the book? I'm like, what book? Like, I said, do you read the book? Show Me Hero. I'm like, you know, I've been meaning to read that book, but I haven't read it. He goes, well, you need to read the book because we've got a meeting scheduled. It was, you know, in a month. So I read the book. I did sort of fall in love with the story. Maybe it's the tragedy of the story that I, you know, because I'm sort of drawn to things like that. And that's how I got involved in it. A couple months later, I made the announcement, or, you know, I told him I was leaving The Sun. I asked him for a buyout, Nestor. I think we talked about this. And they wouldn't give me a buyout. They were offering them. They were not, it was discretionary, I guess. So they.
What about the tragedy that you like? I don't want to play Dr. Melfi here on you, but what about that makes the hook for you that says, I want to be a part of this when you read a book?
Well, first of all, it was unusual in that, the whole thing is a tragedy, really, but, you know, it's one that's not just peculiar to Yonkers, but, I don't know. I'm just drawn to the darkness of things like that. So.
Well, they certainly make television, right? I mean, television has to, that works for TV.
Well, I don't know. I'm not a TV guy, believe it or not. You know, I still don't think of myself as a TV guy. So it's, to me, it's compelling because it is what life is for, you know, life and death is, I mean, how much more compelling do you get? Can you get than that? So I don't know. So that's what
we're talking about, a mayor, Bill, for folks who are not familiar with the story, who it was part of a judicial ruling that Yonkers had to move forward. And correct me if I'm wrong. I'm trying to remember back when I saw the show, had to move forward with affordable housing. And his approach was to really spread the units out all over Yonkers. It wasn't like creating a concentration of poverty. So it was really sort of, am I correct? 25 units here and 25 units there, and was incredibly controversial.
I think I don't want to get lost in the weeds, which is
right.
Actually, I would prefer to get lost in the weeds because that's what I do. But the order came down from Judge Sand to build 200 units of public housing. So it wasn't even affordable housing. This is sort of the same principle in a sense.
Right.
Put it somewhere else other than downtown where all the high rises are. And that was, you know, that was the order. And he brought on a guy by the name of, it doesn't matter. So they come up with a plan to spread it out. And the judge buys into that. And he orders the judicial order is actually just build 200 units of housing, you know. Of public housing, so that's the short version. That's about as short as it can make it. But they come up with this plan to build, as you say, 20 units here, 25 units here, blah blah blah. And the council was required to sign off on it. It was almost just a. Well, they were required to sign off on it, and they wouldn't sign off on it. And it's a different form of government than we're used to around here. It was what they call a weak mayor form of government. And weren't you an administrator? Weren't you the county administrator for a while?
Yes. Well, so, no, I was the chief of staff, so I'm very much involved in that issue.
Okay, but you know. The county administrator really runs the county, you know, or ran the county in Yonkers, even though there was a mayor, you know, on paper. And that was Nick Wasisco, who was the mayor. And it just turned into, I don't know what I can say on a podcast, but it was a circus. It was an absolute circus that drew the national press, you know, national media attention, you know, the judge threatened to send the four recalcitrant, or what it is now, three or four recalcitrant councilmen who wouldn't vote for it to jail. I mean, it was sort of a forerunner of, you know, the Donald Trump syndrome. But anyway.
We mean not following the law.
Correct.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, becoming a victim and, you know, as, you know, as a result, I'm a victim. They're pillaring me for, you know, because I'm just standing up for the rights, you know, of whatever. Making America great again. I don't know. So Hank Spallone and these guys were, they just stood in the way, and this went on for, this dragged on. So, I mean, that's kind of the short version. It doesn't sound very compelling, but.
But it's compelling. And then of course the suicide, which to this day, I think, right, Bill, there's no clear, I mean, people only surmise from what I gather, why the suicide, whether it was he feared he was going to be indicted, whether it was the pressure of trying to bring about this societal change. There's no real clear answer, was there, as to why the suicide?
No, there isn't. I mean, it's a miss. He didn't leave a note. And, you know, there is even for a while there was, as there always seems to be, an idea that, you know, he may have been murdered out there at the cemetery. So, which is where he kills himself.
Right. But, so before Show Me a Hero, you and your writing pal, Mr. Simon, get involved in a little show that's took on a life of its own called The Wire. And I guess and you won awards for The Wire, were nominated for certain episodes that you wrote. You actually had a bit part in The Wire. You were,
wait a minute, a bit part. I was in 9 episodes.
There you go. Okay. A recurring role.
That was a principal role. It was, you know, got me in the Screen Actors Guild.
Nice. Got a card. Nice.
How much of The Wire, Bill, came from your work at The Sun and what you were covering?
Well, let me just back up a second. The I didn't get involved in The Wire at that. I really made the jump to go write or work on, and I didn't know a thing about how to write a screenplay, but that's another story. To go right into Show Me a Hero. It was only as things evolved, although I acted, I might add, you know, Nestor, just, and I'll be signing autographs later. But
you acted like a reporter, right?
I did. I played a foul-mouthed, cantankerous reporter named, oddly enough, named Bill Zorzi. And
who cast that? Your buddy Simon?
I think he did. And
it's an inside job.
Yeah. So I in season one, but I didn't really start on staff until season 3. So I was in 3, 4, and 5, or wrote right for 3, 4, and 5.
Bill, now that I've had you here 30 minutes, I'm going to like be really honest with you. And I ran into
over?
Simon. No, I ran into Simon 6 weeks ago, right before Christmas at an event. And I know him enough that he knows who I am. But we were in the same, I know Raphael better through real life and, you know, 30 years later or whatever. And David's going on to do his thing. And I bump into him in places. I've never watched The Wire, and I know how wonderful, how incredible as an art piece of art it is. And
how do you know?
And Don, well, hold on, Don. Well, because I follow the internet and I live here and I'm from here.
Oh,
and okay. Everywhere I go, it says Baltimore on my card, my hat, my shirt, the Ravens logo, whatever. And I know people love it. And I love The Sopranos. So I've seen every episode of The Sopranos. So I like good drama. I was never attracted to it, and maybe you get this, maybe you don't. I lived literally here. I lived on the 23rd floor at Harbor Court since 2003, the last 20 years. I saw the city on fire when Freddie Gray happened. I saw the plumes of smoke, all of that.
Media and elitist.
It just wasn't the image of it that people portray to me with Baltimore, with crime, that, you know, all the stuff that I see, that I talk about on my show, that I've embraced the conversation around how we make our city better, which a lot of people have run from. But I just don't want to see that and be in that right now. I think it's a thing like Hemingway books I'm going to read later in my life. Can you literally, and I'm not trying to be trite, make a case for why I should watch it? Because I'm going to watch it. I just didn't want to watch it in Baltimore in my 40s when I lived there, like in the city. I don't want to see that side because I know how true some of it is.
Well, I mean, I think it's all pretty true. I mean, it's fictional, but it's all based on reality. And it's not just, you know, a drug investigation and, you know, it's not just the drug world. Like each season, I think of it this way, and I've said this before, each season, the universe expands by a circle, like, you know, and I'm not talking about a circle of hell, but, you know, they look at the death of work in season two, and they look at the beginning of politics in season three, and they look at the school system in season four, and then they look at the media in season five. So
that's what makes it so meaty, is that it peels back an onion that you have to stay in. And I know that I'm going to watch it front to back. I just, from the people who made it, if I sit with David over a coffee one day, I would just ask him, like, make a pitch for why this is essential for me to spend, what, 50, 60 hours of my life doing it, that I know I need to do it, because Don yells at me because I feel like there's a point of reference for Baltimore that everyone else has this, whatever the opinion of not just the art of what it is, but of Baltimore, you know, like
that
it was so good that people think it's real.
we finally wore my brother and sister-in-law down, because like you, they were holdouts. And I will tell you that 2 months ago, because it takes a couple of months if you're going to watch all five.
How many seasons, episodes? Is it 60 or like that?
It is 60.
Okay. Yeah, well, so okay, I was guessing. Okay. Fair enough.
It's going to take you a while, but I will tell you that my brother Mike and my sister-in-law Bridget will now say to me, I can't believe we never watched this. It's one of the greatest things we've ever seen. And Bill, congratulations on being part of something that's iconic.
20 years later, we're still talking about it.
There's never a list of television series that it's not listed as one of the best.
Well, there's not a lot of things. I don't want to say I'm ashamed, but embarrassed that I've never – people get really pissed at me when I say I've never seen The Wire, and I'm like –
I think you should be more embarrassed that you haven't read any Hemingway.
There's
amen,
a farewell
Bill.
Arms.
Amen. Oh. Hey, Bill, I agree. Back to The Wire.
Yeah.
Did you have – I think it has some of the most compelling characters ever, from Stringer Bell to Corsetti to McNulty to Bunk. Was there a character that – I've heard writers say before, I loved that character. Was there a character that you really liked writing for?
Well, I did most of the political line. So I have to admit, I liked writing the Norman Wilson character.
Now tell folks who that is if they're not familiar.
He sort of became the aide-de-camp and then, I guess, the chief of staff of sorts to Mayor Carchetti, Aidan Gillen, who was a good guy. And he's named for a guy who worked at the Evening Sun, who, when the papers were merged, came over as night editor on the Morning Sun. I don't know if you knew him, Nestor, or not, but if he was there when you were there, Norman Wilson. So that he, to me, as the foil to Carchetti, he was fun to me to write, you know. I mean, there are other characters like, you know, even walk-on characters like the old Italian mayor. Who could that be? Who gives his little speech to Carchetti and at lunch that day about, like, what it's like being mayor.
Right. And with Tommy, I call that the Tommy D'Alessandro.
It's exactly
character.
What it is.
You had, obviously, anybody watches that.
No wonder, you know, people think this is realistic, because you started pegging, you know, Martin O'Malley and real people and all. Was Governor Schaefer involved in it? Was there a Mayor Schaefer character in any way?
There was not. There was not. I don't believe. But I mean,
you couldn't write one like that. It's too unique. Nobody believe it.
My friend, the governor. It's not high on his must see TV list.
Haven't watched it.
I'm sure Bill has heard that before. Bill, there was also, I thought, a terrific character. I'll call the Larry Young character. right?
I don't know. I don't know.
Okay. Fair enough. I mean, go to.
It might be the Clarence Mitchell III character. I don't know. It's like some people have guessed that as well, but I don't know.
Well, go before we talk about We Own This City, your latest project. Go to 10,000 feet. What is the Baltimore that is portrayed over five seasons of The Wire? What is the Baltimore, and is it a universal story of the challenges of urban America?
I think so. I mean, I think that's exactly right. I think the universality of it is the appeal of it. I mean, I'd like to think that it's compelling television from a dramatic sense, but these are all problems that we face, you know, as a nation, and, you know, as that universe gets smaller, you know, as a resident of the city or whatever. And, you know, we tried to make it, I think, as real as possible.
I mean, there are lots of stringer bells across the United States of America, right? There are stringer bells who are running these, I'll call them mini cartels, for lack of a better word, all across America. Am I correct?
Yeah, I think it is to a lesser degree now, because I think everybody seems to be in the game. So, you know, the old oligarchs, if you will, sort of, they've been replaced by, you know, a million corner boys, you know. I mean, there are, obviously, the feds will tell you this, there are big drug dealers and suppliers out there in the world. But the game, as they call it, is different on the street now.
Sometimes the cartel are the cops, right?
Well, what a segue.
I do this for a living professionally, Bill. I mean, you write transitions. You know, this is all part of.
Well, there you go. I'm gonna say what a transition. We're with longtime Sun reporter Bill Zorzi, famous by way of HBO. A little detour along the way to the Maryland Matters, which most of us go to right away when we wake up every morning. Bill, we had Justin Fenton on back when the book came out, We Own This City. And I told everyone, I probably sold 50 copies in a week, because everybody I talked to.
I don't know that I had a segment ever on the political side that for a month, everybody came up to me and said, oh my God, I got to get the book. I can't believe, you know, like it was one of those things that it sort of sells itself. And again, it's true life carnage in Baltimore, right? Like literally that's what you're chronicling.
And that's where I start with Bill now. Bill, having covered the crime beat for 20 years in Baltimore, for the folks who don't know, We Own This City is about Baltimore's gun trace task force, police run amok. Was Justin's book surprising to you, or did you go, no kidding?
No, it was surprising to me. I know I'm not a great interview because I think I've already warned you about that. But
I find it pretty compelling.
So yeah, I've enjoyed having you on, actually. I don't think you're a willing participant, but I think I can Melfi you out. That's where I get my gift, is to get the best out of you, Bill.
Well, nobody's making me walk this plank. I'll just say that. Other than Don, he sort of sweet talked me into
questions about all of this, right?
So, but go back. You said you were. I'm fascinated by that answer, and I want you to
explain. You saw everything, right? You've seen everything.
Well, yeah, I would like to think of it. I haven't seen. You know, who would have thunk that Russia would be invading Ukraine? But that's another story. when I got wind of this, when I was approached about this, you know, I was like, Christ, you know, I don't want to write another, you know, dirty cop story. And I just, you know, it's not that interesting to me. It's not that compelling. And, you know, I mean, that scene, and I didn't know anything about it. And then I started, you know, it was sort of like, well, come on, take a look, blah, 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 blah. So I started reading, you know, the indictments. I started reading the search warrant affidavits. I started reading, you know, more and more about this. And it was shocking. I mean, it was shocking.
Because it was so systemic, because so many people had to be in on it for it to work.
Well, just that it worked at all and went on for, you know, I mean, I guess it didn't go on for that long. It just seemed like went on for that long. But it, as it turned out, it is systemic when you look at how these guys came up and how they were trained over time, you know, sort of what had happened to the police department, or how it had changed just in, you know, 20 years. And, for any number of reasons. And then the other piece of this, which is not really so much in Justin's book, but the other piece is that we sort of smushed together, which is a filmmaking term of art, I think, smushed, is the DOJ's investigation and Department of Justice's investigation and assessment of the police department. And it's some of its constitutional failings. And
you're talking about the consent decree?
Absolutely, the consent decree. So we there's a whole storyline built around that that kind of happened simultaneous with this GTTF investigation.
So now, will the HBO series, and it would be malpractice on our part to not ask you your thoughts on a real tragedy. I mean, there were so many tragedies, and we own this city. As I said, I kept telling people, you'll read it in a day and your day will be shot because you won't be able to put it down. I mean, I just kept zoom, 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 zoom through the book. I guess the last tragedy in the book, beyond Wayne Jenkins and all that. And, you know, luckily I used to say, bless myself and say novenas every time I'd get to a part about Baltimore County. And thank goodness, every time it got to Baltimore County, our county police officers did the right thing. I'm going, whoo, thank goodness. You know, hey, if there's anybody that comes out, you know, on the right side of this, it's the Baltimore County police. I was so grateful. But right.
Oddly enough, the Harford County Sheriff's Department.
And the Harford County Sheriff. Yeah, absolutely. So we end up with this tragedy that is Sean Souter. Does the series end and cover the Sean Souter tragedy as it makes it to HBO? Does that make it to the screen, Bill?
It does make it. In fact, the Sean Souter character is, we see him throughout the series.
What is your, you've written about it, you've read about it. Nestor and I have gotten so many different pieces about Souter. Where do you land now as someone who studied it and written about it, as to what happened to Sean Souter?
Like what happened in the large sense, or just down to the question of whether he killed himself or whether he was killed?
Both. Large sense, and then whether he killed himself.
I believe he did kill himself. That's what I believe. And you know, I think it really is a tragedy, a horrible tragedy. And I don't know the extent that he was really ever involved in, certainly not the antics of what we've come to know as the GTTF, episode and policing. But, you know, I think he may have witnessed things that he was duty bound to report and didn't. And I think that just ate at him eventually. That's what I think.
Well, but Bill, as someone who dug in and was known as a tough reporter, go back to Nestor's question, because it's one that we've been unable to answer. And I've had FOP on. I've had the police chief was on. I've never gotten what I find to be a satisfactory answer to Nestor's question, which is, how the hell did all of this happen? Yet we're supposed to believe that the higher ups didn't know what was going on with a wink, wink, nod, nod. What? Put your reporter hat back on. What are we supposed to believe about who knew what about the gun trace task force?
I mean, is your question, do I think that they knew that they were out there robbing drug dealers and you know, sticking up people and
willing to look the other way because Jenkins and his guys were racking up huge arrest numbers? Yes, that is the question.
Well, I don't know that I personally believe that the hierarchy of the Baltimore City Police Department like looked the other way because and knew what they were doing. I don't believe that. And maybe I'm being naive.
That's reassuring to me.
But
bringing guns in, right?
They were bringing guns in.
They were exactly why they're the kind of cop we want to have. They're getting guns off the street, right?
Exactly. And dope off the street and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And
the bad guys.
Motivated, and you've been very generous. We won't keep you much longer. What, when you look at it now, you and Simon and Justin, what motivated Wayne? You love complex characters. It's what drew you to Show Me a Hero. You had them in spades in The Wire. Who is Wayne Jenkins? Tell folks that. What makes a Wayne Jenkins?
Wow. Do you have any easy questions? I don't know. I mean, you know, the guy grew up in on the East Side.
In Essex, he was an Essex guy, right? EVT guy, right?
Baltimore County, and I think he was an HVAC guy at some point, and then you know he joins the Marines, and I don't know what makes that. You know, I mean.
Power makes that, right?
Well, power makes greed, yeah. Power and greed.
I mean, it was so much money. I mean, I can imagine. I can't wait to see I can imagine these scenes where they're out in the back in a garage giving bags of money to. I mean, we're talking big, big dollars, right?
Well, by the way, I want to promote this just so we get it square. It premieres April 25th on HBO. Am I saying that correct, Bill?
That's what I understand.
Yeah. I'm just reading off the web here, and everybody can go watch it if you have HBO. And obviously, we're going to have Justin Fenton on as well, who wrote the book. So I just don't want people to be lost in what we're talking about. That this is a real thing. That's a couple of weeks away from it's done, right? It's in the it's six episodes, correct?
Six episodes, and it's in. I think the final throws the post production up in New York. So
does actor Bill Zorzi? Did he get a call back on this one?
No, he didn't. He's been working on other things, so he's been very busy.
What's next for Bill Zorzi as we wrap it up? What's next on your to-do list?
Well, I'm focused on my contractual obligation to finish writing a book about with David Simon, my occasional partner.
Give him my love.
As soon as I hear from him again, I will. So, about the rise of the drug culture in Baltimore. So, it's sort of a historical nonfiction narrative of, you know, going back to 1950 and coming forward. So,
Can't wait. We'll have you back on as that project evolves. Regardless of what you think or what you say, terrific guest. Bill Zorzi, longtime Baltimore Sun, HBO fame.
Started slow. He didn't trust me. He's a reporter. And then, you know, then I won him over. So, Bill, I'll say this with Simon, because I just want to, like, he's never going to do the show. He's got an open invite. Dave, if you're out there, we're looking for you. Come have a crab cake. Sit next to me. But I have this book that I acquired in the 90s. What?
Simon, how come I don't get an offer for a crab cake?
Oh, you do.
That's a standing offer. When do you want to come out? Meet me at Mama's on the half shell next Friday. I'll see you there. I'm doing the crab cake tour. I absolutely. Now, I've got you on film, so now you have to come out. But with Simon, he's so beautifully profane on social media. And I have this book of maledicta that is all of these insults over the ages in all of these languages translated. And I told him when I saw him, the only thing I think about is like all the stuff he's done, Wire, all these world stuff. All I think about is you're the most profane MF-er I've ever met. And I have a book to give to you that's going to make you even more profane, because he works in it like an art form. I mean, it really, he's an incredible follow, a very unique follow on social media, you must admit.
I don't have anything to do with social media.
You miss all the humor.
Bill's the writer. That's why
Simon's got a hell of a sense of humor. Let me tell you
He's still offended. He's still offended that you haven't read Hemingway. I mean, what the hell? I mean, I don't know what to say.
Here's what I'm going to do, and I'm going to make a promise to you from your art. I am absolutely going to watch this series because I am fascinated.
Which one? You haven't seen any of them yet. You haven't read Hemingway.
Thank you, Bill.
How is it that you keep your
job? You didn't write Hemingway. We own this city. This is a parting shot for you, and this is serious business. Why do I need to watch it? And in your way of putting this together, this is a true story that you're trying to bring to life with true facts, right? So you talked about writing writing for television being different. What are we going to see in these six episodes that maybe mirror the book or in some way change how much Don loved the book?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I assume it'll give you some sort of insight into, you know, while it's dramatized, it's based on fact. And, you know, how policing exists in the city of Baltimore, or did at least through Freddie Gray and, you know, until 2007, March 1st, I think it was, they busted these guys. And then where we are today is a whole other thing. But, you know, I think it gives you an idea of how we got to where we are, really. So, you know, I think anybody who cares about what is happening in the city and wants some sort of insight and understanding as to how we got here, I think it's valuable in that regard.
Last question. Real quick, Bill, because Nestor got me thinking about this when he just asked what's in. When you write for the screenplay, do you as a writer, and Nestor's a writer, do you have to become Wayne Jenkins at moment? Do you have to then become Jay Landsman? Do you have to become, do you have to think like each character? How does the process work?
Well, that's sort of a big question, but yeah.
It's next episode.
I think you do. Yeah, I'll come back. How about if I come back tomorrow? But no, I mean, I remember talking to this guy who had been a councilman in Yonkers, and I was trying, he was like, why do you, you know, it's all in the record. I don't know what do you need from me? Why do you want to talk to me? I was like, because I don't have the voices in my head.
There you
and
go.
And then I thought to myself, this guy thinks this guy will never goddamn, excuse me, this guy will never talk to me now because he thinks I have voices in my head. You know? But he did. And he was, you know, he was very helpful actually, but that's exactly right. And the other thing that I guess is different about, I mean, really markedly different is, you know, the show don't tell, of screenwriting or television writing, where my whole life had been spent telling. That's a newspaper's job, to tell you what happened. Here's what happened, not to show you what happened and let you think about it, you know, or, you know, guide you through, you know, some sort of evolution and, you know, so, you know, when I first, my first attempt at screenwriting, I would write these long sections of dialogue because I felt I had to explain what's going on, you know, because that's what we do. That's what we do ideally in, you know, in reporting the news. So, you know, on a piece of paper, you never want to see a block of copy like that in a screen, you know, of dialogue, you know, because people don't talk like that. Especially except Nestor here.
Yeah, when I'm on the radio. Right, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. I knew you were going to say that. I knew that. Bill, we really Nestor. Appreciate you having you on, and I definitely want to get a crab cake. And if you must be Fadley's, come on down to Lexington Market, tell some stories or whatnot, or we'll get you over to Costas or Pappas or Conrad's, one of the places we're going to be going next couple months. But really appreciate the time, and I'd love to have you back. I'd love to have David on too, but only as a willing guest. We're not going to do root canal with Dave, but to promote the series. Seriously,
it's like, you know, a root canal or a proctology exam. You know, it's one or the other.
With Dave is, and here's the issue, because I do have an FCC license, and I do drop 2 of the 7 Carlin words from time to time when I'm really angry, but not the other 5. I have to let Dave work blue. You know what I mean? Like, if Dave's going to come on the show, if he worked blue, maybe then we could, you know, have him on the program. But I really do want to promote.
It's like show business talk. Like, who, work blue? What is that? You mean you know?
We'll have David just for a podcast episode that we won't put on the radio. Then you'll be good to go.
When I want to be abused by my guest for a crab cake, I'm going to have Bill Zorzi come by.
So. You should call me, because I've been holding back, Nestor. I just wanted to let you know. And I do remember you. I do remember you from the newsroom, as I recall.
Oh, what did I do?
You were like the agate clerk in sports.
I was. So I was a scoreboard guy.
That's about as low as you can be in the newsroom.
I was 17.
I know. No. I think that's where Raphael started, doing the same thing.
I had the same job Larry Short had. It was great. I didn't pick up his accent, but I love Larry.
I don't think he did have the same job as Larry Short.
We were editorial assistants, according to the Baltimore Washington Newspaper Guild.
That's right.
Bill Zorzi, man, we appreciate you. Don, get us out of here.
I'm going to say, be careful. Raphael and I will sing the Mount St. Joe fight song. Tremendous, legendary Bill Zorzi, HBO, coming up April 25th. We own this city. You won't want to miss it. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And if you're into We Own This City, we're also going to have Justin Fenton on a little later. I'm going to talk about journalism and newspapers and banners and sons and all that good stuff. Maryland Crab Cake Tour comes to Mama's on the Half Shell and Nacho Mama's down in Canton. We'll begin that on March 4th. Every Friday, we're going to have a crab cake tour and doing something really special in the month of May. I'll be telling you more about. Big appreciation to our friends at the Maryland Lottery for letting us play with that. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking. Baltimore, positive.